It is now my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Robert Mayer, the convener of this Treasure Seminar Series. Of course, Rob hardly needs any introduction. He is well known as an expert in the Tibetan tantric traditions, with a particular focus on the Nyingma Tantras and on Buddhism during the time of the Tibetan Empire. His academic education started with a BA at Bristol, where he studied with such well-known authorities as Paul Williams and Stephen Collins. He completed a PhD at Leiden, for which his main influences, as he wrote to me, included Tilman Vetter, Alexis Sanderson, Dan Martin, Gurmit Dorje, and Cathy Cantwell. Rob Mayer has spent most of his academic career at Oxford, with shorter periods in the School of Anthropology at the University of Kent, as a visiting professor at Humboldt University in Berlin, and as a fellow of the Käthe Hamburger Kolleg at Ruhr University Bochum in Germany. Most of his research focuses on the early Nyingma tradition, and he has collaborated with his wife, Catherine Cantwell, on many publications. Their books include, amongst others, a publication of early Tibetan documents on Purwa from Dunhuang, and A Noble News of Methods, a Mahayoga Tantra and its commentary. Together with Anna Sechnalova and Igor Gritnev, Rob Mayer is a convener of the Oxford Treasure Seminar Series. Previous seminar series held at Merton and Wolfson College in Oxford looked at Tibetan and other Asian treasure traditions in a comparative perspective. This year's Treasure Series is the first to focus on Indian Buddhist traditions. The series will now be rounded off by Rob Mayer's talk, which is titled Dharmabhanakas, Siddhas, Avatarika Siddhas, and Tertans. We look very much forward.
Few would argue with the proposition that Mahayana Buddhism and its tantric offshoots were religions based on the revelation of scriptures. Even the most conservative traditional Buddhist masters will often concede that while sutras, dharanis, and tantras generally purport ultimately to have been taught by the historical Buddha, they had to reach us via circuitous routes that required an additional and subsequent act of revelation into our Jambudvipa. Perhaps I should share my screen, actually. I think we're still on. For the sake of the recording, Ulrika, I think we're going to have to start again, because I can't share my screen. I can only share your screen. Ah, that's more like it. Okay, I'm gonna go back to the beginning. Nope, I still can't reach my, I've only got your screen, Ulrika. Let me try again. We've got this.
I don't think there's anything I can do about
no,
it.
No, maybe there isn't. No. So let's see. Okay, now we can do something about it. So, few would argue with the proposition that Mahayana Buddhism and its tantric offshoots were religions based on the revelation of scriptures. Even the most conservative traditional Buddhist masters will often concede that while sutras, dharanis, and tantras generally purport ultimately to have been taught by the historical Buddha, they had to reach us via circuitous routes that required an additional and subsequent act of revelation into our Jambudvipa. Is it recording? Oh, I do wish Daniel was here.
It is recording, Rob. It says it's recording. Yes.
Okay, good.
The recording button is on.
Okay, good.
We can all see you and we can see your slides.
Okay. Mahayana history in South Asia was therefore the history of more than 1,000 years of continuous ongoing revelation of scriptures previously unheard by humans, beginning with the earliest Mahayana sutras up to the final revelations of the late tantric period. The ongoing revelation of scriptures is surely amongst the most definitive and significant features of South Asian Buddhism, without which it would have been a very different religion. If you want to understand South Asian Buddhism at all, understanding its processes of ongoing scriptural revelation is surely indispensable. Because ongoing revelation of scriptures was so integral to Indian Mahayana, it's hard to imagine how it could have failed to impact on Tibetan Buddhism too. Like their counterparts in China, Tibetan Buddhists must immediately have been confronted in the Mahayana scriptures they translated with numerous narratives describing prophetic declarations made by the Buddha about the future propagations of his sutras by reincarnated Dharmabhanikas who would appear after his parinirvana. More frequently than their Chinese counterparts, especially through the first few centuries of Tibetan Buddhism, numerous Tibetan scholars and translators visiting South Asia must also have encountered actual practices of ongoing tantric revelation, which continued apace and notably in holy places geographically proximate to Tibet, such as Udayana and Bengal. The prolific nature of such tantric revelations in Sanskrit Buddhism should not be underestimated. Excluding Dharanese and later Nepali revelations, Isaacson and Sverre estimate around 5,000 original tantric scriptures of South Asian origins remain extant, some in Sanskrit, others only in Tibetan and Chinese translations, produced over the roughly 500 years from the 6th to the 11th centuries. This gives a very approximate average frequency of around one scriptural revelation every event, one scriptural revelation event per annum through five centuries. The real figure was probably higher, since more texts were revealed than the 500 would survive, and because the Sanskrit tradition resembled its Tibetan successors in re-revealing the same scripture to different persons on different occasions. Scriptural revelations continued in Nepal after the decline of Buddhism in the Indian heartlands. Isaacson and Sverre observed the compilation of tantric scriptures seems to have continued in Nepal almost up to modern times. Some were influential, such as the 15th century revelations of the Svayambhu Purana and the Guna Karandavyuha. The former remains the basis for all the extensive Rutta practices in contemporary Newar Buddhism, and the latter for the important cult of Lokeshwara. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Dun Huang's sources witness a number of indigenous Tibetan tantric scriptures appearing by the 10th century, showing that Tibetans soon produced their own revelations. It's likely they began by adapting the methods of their Indian teachers, since for at least one or two centuries, Tibetan scriptural revelation was contemporaneous with tantric revelations still occurring in India. And early Tibetan scriptures were closely modeled on Sanskrit tantras, albeit with some degree of localization.
Rob, have you deliberately stopped screen sharing?
I'll come to another slide later.
Okay, sorry.
Perhaps unsurprisingly, more surprisingly, little study has yet been made of the impacts of Sanskrit revelatory practices on Tibet. The first phase of Tibetan revelation was characterized by the anonymous production of tantric scriptures in genres first witnessed at Dun Huang, later preserved in the Nyime Jubum canon. Little has been written about this early phase, although it surely influenced later developments. There is also clear overlap of style and content between the earlier anonymous Nyima Tantras and the later Termic texts. It is even claimed that the Nyime Jubum provides the measure by which the validity of Terma is assessed. Any Terma diverging too far from the Nyime Jubum's doctrinal, ritual, and iconographic norms might not be deemed valid. Likewise, some Nyima Jubum texts can simultaneously be classified as Terma, for example, the root tantras of Nyangrao's Kajie Deshe Gupa. And Tetons are still revealing root tantras in the genres of Nyima Jubum texts. Yet all we currently know about this first key phase of Tibetan revelations is that they resemble their South Asian counterparts in being largely anonymous, but in the similar styles and contents of their output. The second phase of revelation, known as Terma, was no longer anonymous. In this, it differed from most Indian Buddhist revelation, but resembled the contemporaneous revelatory practices of nearby Kashmir, where many Tibetans were studying in its Buddhist monasteries. In this Kashmiri tradition of revelation, chiefly associated with the non-dual Shaiva traditions like the Kaula, but also with some Buddhist examples, publicly named scriptural revealers became the new norm. Typically, these Shaivas revealed new tantric scriptures in their holy place of Udayana. The nascent Tibetan Terma system likewise prominently referenced Udayana, citing Udayana Dakinis as agents of revelation and Padmasambhava of Udayana as the patron of revelation, but differed by developing other more specifically Buddhist narratives too. Above all, Tibetan Tetons adapted the aforementioned Mahayana literary device of prophetic declarations made by the Buddha regarding the future propagations of his sutras by reincarnated Dhammabhanikas appearing after his parinirvana. Localizing this Mahayana trope, the Tibetans spun narratives of prophesied reincarnated Tetons discovering sacred texts hidden for later recovery by major Buddhist missionaries to Tibet, notably Vimalamitra and above all Padmasambhava, who now stood in for the Buddha. Similarly, Atisha was said to have discovered such texts in Tibet. Fortunately, the major scholar of Tarma's origins, Ronald Davidson, has consistently understood it as a product of both Indian and Tibetan influences. Less fortunately, perhaps, he never found much time to enlarge on the Indian aspects, mainly focusing on the non-Buddhist indigenous aspects. This is understandable. First, it continues the conversation begun by Eric Haar in the 1960s and continued by Michael Aris in the 1980s. Secondly, the Tibetan aspects are more elusive than the Indian ones because little textual evidence for them survives. Exploring them has thus become an intriguing intellectual challenge that few authors can resist. I confess to being no exception, and I'm developing a major collaborative work on the vital non-Buddhist indigenous influences on the Terma tradition. However, a discussion that merely acknowledges Indian influences without actually examining them is manifestly incomplete. So far, insufficient studies have tackled the Indian influences, and despite Davidson's and Janet Jetzer's assertions of their importance, most authors still overlook them. Obviously, it would be retrograde in the extreme to try to reduce Tibetology to an appendage of Indology, as it sometimes was in its early days, but to ignore the extraordinarily creative civilizational exchanges that occurred between Tibet and South Asia over many centuries would equally be a missed opportunity. This was a rare interaction between two exceptionally vibrant cultural spheres, the study of which offers numerous insights. We will therefore invest a proportionate effort into researching South Asian influences on Terma too. For if we don't know what came with Sanskrit Buddhism, how can we differentiate what was indigenously Tibetan? Moreover, South Asian and indigenous elements tended to merge like the ingredients of a cake after baking, and they've proven very difficult to reverse engineer. Our efforts should therefore not attempt the impossible by presuming to isolate indigenous aspects from the outset. Rather, we should adopt a more holistic perspective that accepts the admixture of South Asian and indigenous cultures as our point of departure. Fortunately, restoring this perspective should not prove difficult, since the thus far ignored South Asian influences on Terma appear easy to access from a plethora of extant textual sources in both Sanskrit and Tibetan translation. Indologists might even find them obvious. Certainly, my undemanding and simple efforts cannot be compared with the brilliance and virtuosity demanded of scholars like Davidson and Guntram Hazard, who have done so much to infer the altogether more elusive non-Buddhist indigenous influences on Terma from sometimes little more than circumstantial evidence. Thus, in a paper in Press, I start by reflecting on the translation of the Indian term nidhi into the Tibetan word ter. The word ter is not evident in Old Tibetan before its usage in Buddhist translations. Joanna Bielek therefore speculates it might have been a Buddhist neologism specifically created to translate the Sanskrit term nidhi. I continue by looking at Guru Chowang's comprehensive explorations of the full range of meanings of this translational term ter, and how he seeks to understand it in the light of the complex Indian understandings of its Sanskrit original nidhi. Being Buddhist, Chowang, like his successors Ratnalingpa and Ugyanlingpa, upholds the old Indian Buddhist enumeration of nidhi as fourfold, distinct from the ninefold enumerations favored by Brahmins and Jains. The Buddhist fourfold enumeration is very old, described in such varied texts as the Mulasavastivada and Vinaya, the Divyavadana, the Mahavastu, Pali commentaries, the Khotani's Book of Zambasta, the Vimalakirti Nidesha Sutra, the Maitreya Vyakarana, the Karmashataka, and plenty more. But the inquisitive Chöwang went much further. I think, it seems, consulting the Tibetan translation of the Amarakosha lexicon, since his exhaustive analysis also subsumes popular Indian understandings of the famous nine nidhis, as found in such texts as the Amarakosha, or the 12th century Jain Hemachandra's Trishashti Shalaka Purusha Charitra. I also translate 16 pages from the Indian Buddhist Arya Vidyotama Mahatantra on the finding and opening of treasure doors or terago, one among dozens of passages on nidhi in Buddhist Kriya Tantras. It describes treasure doors as complex and varied magical portals whose hidden location is disclosed to yogins in dreams by treasure deities. Although guarded by dangerous spirits, great yogins can nevertheless magically open and reclose them to access their treasures. Such material was very likely influential on the Tibetan Tantra tradition. This particular passage has also extensive parallels with the Nidhi Shastras, the manuals of the Nidhi Vardhans, the typically tantric treasure hunters of medieval India, who recovered hidden treasures guarded by territorial deities from the landscape and the elements, as well as from old temples, lingas, religious statues, and the like. Although often typified as Pashupatas, Nalini Balbi reports that their shastras very prominently reference the Buddhist figure Nagarjuna. In a further paper in press, I evaluate Padmasambhava as a siddha within the tantric culture of his native Udayana, a task never previously attempted. Although the term siddha might seem familiar, as we learned from John Nemeth's last month, appearances can be deceptive because siddha had rather differing implications in different genres of Sanskrit literature. In earlier texts such as the epics, Puranas, and in Kavya, siddhas were mythic semi-divine beings who lived in the sky, comparable to Gandharvas, Yakshas, and Devas. In later centuries, Buddhists understood siddhas mainly as human beings who achieved realization through tantric practice. But in Kashmir's non-dual Shaiva traditions, the term was more complex. While some siddhas could approximately resemble the Buddhist definition, others were much more. Divine non-humans, primordially realized from the start, they merely adopted the guise of human siddhas to descend from exalted spiritual planes to specific geographical locations in the Kashmir region, notably Udayana, for the express purpose of disseminating previously unheard tantric scriptures. The term applied to such primordially realized siddhas descended from on high to disseminate tantric scriptures was avataraka, which Sanderson translates as promulgator and Williams as agent of revelation. Another term used was avatirana, implying Shiva descended to earth. Some avataraka siddhas were hugely important, the sources of entire tantric dispensations. Jayarata, for example, described Matsyendranatha as the sole source of revelation of the entire Kaula tradition, while Abhinavagupta described Trayambaka, Amardaka, and Srinatha as respective founders of the non-dual, dual, and non-dual come dual teachings of Shiva. Despite being heavily mythologized, most modern scholars believe the avataraka siddhas were historical persons, and Kalhana's 12th century history of Kashmir, the Raja Tarangini, mentions them. It's still not clear to me if some version of the avataraka siddha trope already accompanied Padmasambhava when he came to Tibet, or if it was retrospectively applied to him in later years. But the more I reflect, the more confident I am that the mythology of Padmasambhava, as preserved in Tibet, reflects the cultural backdrop of the Kashmiri avataraka siddha. It's equally striking how the first emergence of named avataraka siddhas in Kashmir and of named Tautons in nearby Tibet are historically near contemporaneous, and that the mythology of the Tibetan Tautons refers so repeatedly to Udayana. Again, Tibetology has sought for many years, but without complete success, to understand the Padmasambhava and related Terma mythology exclusively through the prism of Tibetan history and Tibetan culture. Again, these tasks might have been eased a bit by considering from the outset the distinctive Kashmiri cultural background as well. Still awaiting my attention is a comparison of the constant references to Dakinis in the Tibetan Karma tradition with the prominent role of Dakinis in Indian Vajrayana revelation. For the rest of today's presentation, I will return to the Mahayana theme of Dharmavarnikas reincarnating into future times to propagate sutras they had first heard directly from the Buddha in his own lifetime, and how it came to play a highly visible role in the construction of Tibetan Karma narratives. This also permits me to correct a mistake I made in a recent article, Rethinking Treasure Part 1, where I gave a brief preview of this topic in advance of a more detailed study. In Rethinking Treasure Part 1, I described themes shared by an Indian Mahayana sutra, the Pratyutpanna Buddha Samukha Avastita Samadhi Sutra, henceforth Pratyutpanna, and the Tibetan Karma traditions. The Pratyutpanna has been extensively studied by Paul Harrison, and much of its materials on the concealment and revelation of Mahayana sutras do indeed find striking parallels in Tibetan Karma traditions, so that my analysis was partially correct. However, I also made a naive mistake. I imagined the Pratyutpanna was somehow unique, or at least rare, in containing such narratives. On the contrary, as we learned from David Drewis last week, the scenario described in the Pratyutpanna is neither rare nor unique. The diametric opposite is actually the case. This narrative structure is so commonplace in Mahayana sutras, so ubiquitous, that it constitutes what David Drewis has termed the standard claim of Mahayana sutra literature, and is replicated in dozens of different Mahayana sutras as a prime method of explaining their existence. As David Drewis explained, the standard claim is that the Buddha spoke the sutra to bodhisattvas during his final life and appointed them with the task of returning to this world to reveal them 500 years later. This scenario is actually presented already in the Ashtasahasrika. Numerous Mahayana sutras contain self-referential narratives intended to explain their own existence, a necessity since Mahayana sutras were not passed down through the traditional agamas or nikayas, yet nevertheless claimed to be the Buddha's own speech. The internal logic of these narratives partly resembles that of the Jatakas, the stories of the Buddha's past lives, with similar themes of karmic cause and effect, of travel through time and of reincarnation. But the Mahayana Sutra narratives focus specifically on how the sutras will continue to be propagated after the Buddha's Nirvana. The Pratyutpanna's narratives to this effect are typical of many others. Most occurs in chapter 13, which opens with the interlocutor, the layman Bhadrapala, asking the Buddha, "Reverend Lord, at a future time, in that age, following the Nirvana of the Tathagata, will the Samadhi of the Pratyutpanna circulate and spread here in Jambudvipa?" The Buddha replies that while the Samadhi of the Pratyutpanna will continue to circulate for a while after his Nirvana, at a later date, copies of it will have to be sealed within caskets, Dombu, and hidden in caves, stupas, rocks and mountains, where they will be protected by Nagas and such like deities. Then says the Buddha, in the disastrous last 500 years, when true Dharma is in decline and false Dharma and bad morality prevail, a few beings of exceptional merit and karma will deliberately appear specifically to recover the Pratyutpanna from its hiding places. These special persons will rediscover the Pratyutpanna, make copies of it, study it and expand it to others. On hearing this from the Buddha, the interlocutor Bhadrapala and his layman colleagues were deeply moved and made a mighty aspiration that they should be the ones to reincarnate into that dreadful last 500 years to recover the Pratyutpanna from its places of concealment and teach it to others. But they were not unaware of the gravity of their undertaking and the difficulties with which it would be fraught. For as they observed, they would be proclaiming teachings that will not have been heard before and preaching a profound Dharma in which the inhabitants of future times might not believe. Others in the audience exhorted the Buddha to entrust the Pratyutpanna to these noble volunteers so that they could fulfill their great aspiration, which the Buddha duly did. The Buddha then made precise prophecies specifying the 8 named individuals within his audience who would be the ones to reincarnate in the future to uphold the Pratyutpanna, and enlarged on the vast merits they would thereby acquire. Although the 8 were all laymen, there is no mention of what their status should be when they reincarnate. The Buddha then prophesied that a further 500 persons within his audience would also reincarnate in his future times to receive, make copies of, and further propagate the Pratyutpanna teachings recovered by the reincarnations of the 8 laymen. The similarities of this narrative to Tibetan Tenma narratives are self-evident, and I set them out in more detail in the handout, which is the same as the last three screens. Those unfamiliar with Tibetan, the handout is in the chat. Those unfamiliar with Tibetan Tenma should mainly remember a few key substitutions. Firstly, the location is moved from Jambudvipa in general to Tibet in particular. Secondly, important Buddhist missionaries to Tibet, notably Vimalamitra and above all the second Buddha Padmasambhava, become substituted for the Buddha of the Mahayana texts. Thirdly, the close students of these missionaries, especially those of Padmasambhava, accordingly become the ones prophesied to reincarnate in the future to revive the teachings. And along with this basic narrative framework, some other less crucial details and items of terminology are also adopted. My analysis in Rethinking Treasure Part 1 was therefore partly correct. There are striking parallels between the narratives of the Prajnapanna and of Tibetan Tenma. However, I fail to realize the extent to which the Prajnapanna's narratives are typical of Mahayana sutras in general. As David Drewis has explained, such narratives are the standard claim of Mahayana sutra literature, replicated across numerous sutras to explain their existence. Although not always the same in every detail, the basic structure remains constant in most cases. More pertinently, we can certainly say that many of the famous sutras best known to early Tibetan Buddhism carry such themes, often quite prominently. The Akshayamati Nirdesha, the Ashta Sahasrika, the Karanda Vyuha, the Siddhama Puntarika, the Samadhi Raja, the Savana Bhasotara, the Pratyutpanna, the Vimalakirti, and more that I'm not yet aware of. If Tibetan Tenma literature came to reproduce a conspicuous Mahayana sutra literary trope, then this is not down to the disproportionate influence of a single text, but rather to the pervasive cultural influence of the entire sutra genre. Since this is the case, it becomes much easier to understand what I previously found puzzling. How, when, and why did such narratives become appropriated into Tibetan Tenma literature? To approach these questions, it's best to begin by investigating the nature of Tibetan engagement in Buddhist scholarship in the period leading up to the first appearances of Tenma, which Dan Martin has established as not later than the final decades of the 10th century. In a recent conference presentation, Ulrika Rösler explains that before the 11th century, and especially during the so-called early dissemination of the Dharma in Tibet, the Mahayana Sutra corpus dominated Tibetan Buddhist scholarship. She observed that Mahayana sutras made up approximately two-thirds of all texts listed in the two early imperial translational catalogues, the Denkarma and the Pangtangma. She continued with these words. In addition to the sheer predominance of sutra over shastra in terms of numbers, we are also informed in a document from the Tibetan imperial court that two sutras, the Ratnamegha Sutra and the Lankavatara Sutra, were among the earliest texts translated into Tibetan, and the vocabulary used became normative for subsequent translations. It is therefore evident that during the 8th and 9th centuries, Mahayana sutras were given pride of place among the Buddhist texts received from India and elsewhere. They were among the first Buddhist texts to be translated. They form the largest group of texts among the Buddhist translations, and they are listed first in the imperial catalogues. It was not until the second translation period, from the 11th century onwards, that there was a noticeable shift away from the Mahayana sutras and towards the later stages of tantric literature on the one hand and scholastic literature on the other. Rösler acknowledges that Buddhist translations were an elite activity sponsored by the royal court, and that on the ground, tantric Buddhism was also practiced by often hereditary lay householder lineages, some of which might have been influential, but that in no way detracts from her main point that the period is characterized by the considerable impact of Mahayana sutras amongst those actively involved in the dissemination of Buddhist texts, since those were the greatest and most revered part of the Buddhist translations available at the time. Named kirtans began to appear in the 10th and early 11th century, probably building on already existing traditions. Certainly Shenchen Lugar in the early 11th century describes a Tenma culture already complex and mature, which cannot have been very new in his own time. It therefore seems highly probable that the first kirtans emerged from an intellectual environment preceding the 11th century shift that Rösler describes. In other words, from an intellectual environment where the study of Mahayana sutras was still paramount. And what is so striking about the various early extant Buddhist dharmas is precisely the prominence within them of Mahayana motifs. Two of the earliest surviving Buddhist dharmas, the Kachem Kakoma and the Manikabum, were both allegedly found in the Jokhang in Lhasa, notionally in the 11th century. They share overlapping texts and present the first great Tibet religious king, Sonten Gampo, as an emanation of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. He was to become the patron deity of Tibet. Both these influential early dharmas therefore drew substantially from a famous Mahayana sutra, the Current of Yuha, which introduced for an Indian public the cult of Avalokiteshvara and his mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. The Manikabham has even been described as a reformulation of the Current of Yuha for a Tibetan audience to convey its message of devotion to Avalokiteshvara and his mantra. The discovery of the Kachem Kakoma was attributed to Atisha and hence the Kadampa school. But the Manikabham is a composite dharma with three Nyingma discoverers, Druptop Ngudrup, precise dates unknown, his student Nyangrel Nyima Urze, 1124 to 1192, and Nyangrel's spiritual successor Guru Chöwang, 1212 to 1270. Certainly the Manikabham itself is often counted as the earliest extant really important Nyingma dharma. Yet it draws as heavily on sutra themes as on tantric ones, in contrast to subsequent Nyingma dharmas, which are mostly tantric. The same is true of the early Bon Teoton, Shenchen Lugar. While his dharmas included many genres of scripture, the sutra texts of his Kamgye were by far the greatest in terms of sheer bulk. It's significant that two of the Manikabham's discoverers, Nyangrel and Chöwang, are also considered the earliest and most definitive codifiers of the Nyingma school of Buddhism. Much of their codifications pertain to dharma, including the first comprehensive literary formulations of the narrative structures that framed Nyingma dharma discovery, as well as complex theoretical explorations and practical advice. I'm referring here to such works as Nyangrel's famous biography of Padmasambhava, the Katang Zanglingma, his huge Kajé Deshe Dupa, and Chöwang's analysis of the meaning of the word ter and the practice of its recovery in his Terjong Chenmo. This seems to indicate that the two great masters who did most to codify the Nyingma dharma system were themselves reasonably well-versed in Mahayana sutra literature, because both were also directly involved in the production of a major dharma, the Manikabham, that substantially depended on a Mahayana sutra. In addition, Nyangrel was the author of historical works such as the Chögyal Metal Nyingpo Dantsi Chu that had much to say about general Buddhism in India. In my view, we therefore need not be surprised that Nyangrel was also capable of adapting a prominent Mahayana sutra literary motif for use at the very heart of his vision of dharma, especially since in all likelihood there were already precedents for him to work from. Nor need we be surprised that Chöwang referenced various Mahayana sutra texts in his work. Not everyone agrees with me, however. A colleague recently suggested that Nyangrel was so ignorant about sutras that any similarities between his vision of dharma and Mahayana sutra literary motifs could only be coincidental. So my thinking, while Nyangrel might show little sign of engagement in Shastric Buddhist scholarship, I don't think he was necessarily ignorant of Mahayana sutra literature, which, as Ulrika Roesler points out, remained the predominant field of Buddhist learning until very shortly before Nyangrel's own time. For further circumstantial evidence, I can point to the example of Nyangrel's older contemporary, the Kadampa turned Kajupa, Gampopa Sonam Rinchen, 1079 to 1153. Gampopa was commonly known as Da'ur Shonu or Chandraprabha Kumara, after the protagonist by that name in the Mahayana Samadhi Raja Sutra. In this influential sutra, Chandraprabha Kumara is the principal interlocutor whom the Buddha prophesies will reincarnate as a Dhammabhanaka in a future age to promote the teachings of the Samadhi Raja after the Buddha's Nirvana. According to David Jackson, Gampopa was recognized by his Kadampa teacher Geshe Potowa as the reincarnation of that very same Chandraprabha Kumara from the Samadhi Raja. Thus, according to Jackson, Gampopa's promotion of a controversial and uniquely sutra-based Mahamudra meditation system was interpreted by some of his contemporaries as deriving from the Samadhi Raja, which they believed Gampopa had specifically reincarnated to propagate. Indeed, the central teaching of this Mahayana sutra is a meditation on evenness, or nyampa ni, a key technical term in both Mahamudra and Dzogchen. Be that as it may, we can see that classic Mahayana sutra literary themes of prophecy, reincarnation, and the revelation of previously concealed teachings definitely played a vital role in the tradition building, that characterized 12th century Tibet. In a lecture delivered in Paris on the 23rd of March, Traveling in Time, the Role of Jataka Stories and Prophecies in the Construction of the Kadampa School, Ulrika Roesler gave a fascinating account of the important role of certain classic Indian Buddhist literary conventions in the tradition building texts of the Kadampas. Specifically, she painted a compelling picture of how Jataka and Sutra-derived notions of Vyakarana, time travel, and reincarnation were adapted for incorporation into the narratives of the Pacha and Bhucha of the Kadampa Legbam. And analyzing the Sanskrit term Vyakarana, Roesler explains that it means rather more than its usual translation of prophecy. Vyakarana implies a broader understanding of causality through all the three times of past, present, and future, a supernormal knowledge or abhijna, accessible only to extremely advanced beings and a necessary component of a Buddha's omniscience. In these Kadampa narratives, Atisha thus assumes a role parallel to the Buddha of the Indian literary prototypes, while Atisha's leading disciples assume roles parallel to those of the Buddha's leading disciples. When Atisha discloses the past and future births of his disciples to illustrate their long-standing karmic destinies with his teachings through many lifetimes, he thereby simultaneously signals his own Buddha-like knowledge of the three times. Turning now to the most influential Tibetan Dharma tradition, the still thriving practices of the Nyingma school, we again find such knowledge of the three times central to their narratives. But as David Gray showed us 3 weeks ago, scriptural revelation in Tantric Buddhism is often visionary in nature. Hence, by the 12th century, Nyingma Dharma ideology had become articulated and codified into what I am very provisionally going to call a vision myth or maybe a vision narrative. I'm not sure yet. I'm referring here to the coherent and consistent, but nevertheless flexible, mythic narrative structure woven around the life story of Padmasambhava, which has determined the shape and content of the visionary experiences of all Nyingma treasure finders since the 12th century. By lending form to their visionary experiences, it has also shaped and predicted the content of their actual treasure discoveries. In turn, the vision myth itself becomes reaffirmed, perpetuated, and enriched with each subsequent visionary experience and with each subsequent treasure discovery, century after century. While this vision myth has perhaps served most prominently to underpin the ongoing revelations of new termas, it simultaneously supports most other aspects of Nyingma ritual practice and identity. Hence, these are often inseparably connected with treasure discovery and with Padmasambhava. Anthropologists might detect some resemblance between my provisional terminology of vision myth or vision narrative with the idea of the myth dream proposed by the Canadian anthropologist Kenelm Burridge and subsequently adapted by further anthropologists. Recently, Charles Stewart used Burridge's ideas in his fascinating study of the key role played by communally occurring and communally curated religious dreams in the miraculous rediscoveries by a Greek Orthodox community of a series of long-hidden ancient sacred icons reputedly buried on the island of Naxos by ancient Christian refugees from Egypt. These dreams were received by several different persons, continued over time, and were characterized by specific, coherent, repeated narratives. They indicated to the villagers where they should dig to find the icons, also illustrating their ancient origins and sacred power. Today, after decades of sustained religious outpouring, these icons form the basis of one of the major pilgrimage sites in Greek Christianity. The myth dream Stewart describes in Naxos is not very unusual, and ethnographers have described comparable examples in various parts of the world. It's remotely possible that what David Drewes has termed the standard claim of the Mahayana Sutras was one such myth dream, since it worked as an implicit mythic structure that lent a unifying cohesion to the multifarious revelations of Mahayana sutras by different Dharmaparinikas over long periods of time. But what sets the Nyingma vision myth apart from the myth dreams of most other cultures, including the Mahayana, is the comprehensive manner in which it has been extracted from its wider contexts and developed into an independent theme, moving from the implicit to the explicit, becoming formally codified and organized, being committed to writing not merely once, but many times over, and developed as a major literary genre in its own right. As far as we currently know, the Nimoy vision myth was first committed to writing in the 12th century by Nyangrel in his seminal Katang Zhanglingma, although Nyangrel definitely drew on earlier sources. In a variation on Potowa's recognition of Gampopa as the reincarnation of Chandraprabha Kumara and setting a precedent for all subsequent tetons, Nyangrel saw himself as a prominent figure from the vision myth. He was the reincarnation of Padmasambhava and Vimalamitra's most illustrious disciple, the Emperor Trisong Detson. Hence, he was able to rediscover both the Purba Trinley section and the actual root tantras of the great Deshik Dupa cycle directly from the emperor's own personal manuscripts, the very same manuscripts entrusted by Vimalamitra and Padmasambhava to the emperor 400 years previously and then concealed as Terma. Further iterations of the Nima vision myth were subsequently committed to writing by numerous later masters, notably Ugin Lingpa's 14th century Pema Katang. The Nimoy vision myth became so influential that it now counts as a cultural property of all Tibetans, regardless of schools or lineage. The name given to such text is Katang, which is difficult to translate. Dictionaries give such words as order, edict, or command, but add that it usually refers to the biographies of Padmasambhava concealed as Terma treasures. The religious aspects of the Katang genre remain less explored than historical, yet the primary function has always been religious. Playing a key role in the inner religious lives of contemporary Nyingmas, it informs their meditative experiences, religious dreams, and visions, while also shaping their revelations of Terma. Its relation to ritual performance is equally pronounced. Whole episodes of the Katang can originate in tantric ritual, subsequently transcribed into symbolic narratives about Padmasambhava. Katang-based liturgies, such as Rigsin Gurdjieff's Le Dunma, or recited at the 10th day Tsok or Gana Chakra, which itself worships the Padmasambhava of the Katangs, an interesting contrast to the Dharmapanika performances described to us in February by Natalie Gama. One could cogently argue that the Katang narratives enjoy even more life within their countless liturgical and visionary and ritual manifestations than in the few famous hagiographies by Nyangrel or Ugin Lingpa. In these intensely devotional narratives, themselves mainly discovered as Termas, Padmasambhava is envisaged as the second Buddha, a direct emanation of Amitabha, who takes miraculous birth, fully formed and fully enlightened upon a magical lotus on a lake in Udayana. Like his Avatarika Shaiva counterparts, his purpose in manifesting is to teach non-dual tantras never previously heard by humans. But he also has a special karmic relationship with Tibetans so that he can manifest teachings for them that no other nations have received. Thus, the Katang texts usually place special emphasis on his stay in Tibet with a discussion of his prolific concealment of Termas in the Tibetan landscape. And here the Katang literature borrows a major narrative framework from the Mahayana Sutra literary conventions previously described. As a knower of the three times, the second Buddha Padmasambhava has the ability to understand all karmic causes and effects in the minutest detail. Like the Buddha of the Mahayana Sutras, he too can foresee the future vicissitudes of his teaching dispensation down to the smallest particulars. Armed with that foresight, like the Buddha of the Mahayana Sutras, he can see that the teachings he has just given his disciples in 8th century Tibet will need to be concealed for a time and then re-revealed in future centuries. Like the Buddha in the Mahayana Sutras, Padmasambhava's knowledge of even the most minute workings of Pratichasamutpada allow him to discern to which of his disciples he should at this moment entrust each particular teaching, and in which particular future time and in which precise location in Tibet they must be reborn to recover those teachings. He also knows exactly where, when, and with which companions they should recover them in those future lives. Like the Buddha's students in the Mahayana Sutras, Padmasambhava's students too are inspired to take mighty vows to be reborn in those future times to uphold the teachings with which Padmasambhava has entrusted them. Accordingly, like the Mahayana Sutras, Katang texts attribute prophecies to Padmasambhava in which he discloses details about the future vicissitudes of his teachings, their concealments, his entrustment of those teachings to his close students, the vows of those students to be reborn to propagate them in future lives, and many particulars about their rediscoveries. Ugyen Lingpa's Pema Katang is perhaps the most famous for its sheer quantity of prophecies, but all Katang texts describe them. Turning from Katang ideology to the practical mechanics of revelation in Tibet, we find that tantric and indigenous themes play equally prominent roles, which we have no time to discuss here. Nevertheless, I should mention that the outer classificatory envelope containing these mechanics once again adopts Mahayana categories as paramount. Paul Harrison has researched Indian Mahayana scriptural revelation for many years. He argues that its various mechanics of revelation are summarized in Shanti Deva's Shiksa Samuchchaya, where it cites a passage from the Sarva Punya Samuchchaya Samadhi Sutra. Harrison translates as follows. Vimala Tejas, the Buddhas and Lords resident in other world systems, show their faces to reverent and respectful Bodhisattvas and Mahasattvas wanting the Dharma, and they cause them to hear the Dharma. Vimala Tejas, treasures of the Dharma are deposited in the interiors of mountains, caves, and trees for Bodhisattvas and Mahasattvas wanting the Dharma, and endless Dharma teachings in book form come into their hands. Vimala Tejas, deities who have seen former Buddhas provide Bodhisattvas and Mahasattvas wanting the Dharma with the inspired eloquence of Buddhas. A parallel tripart classificatory structure was applied to Buddhist revelation in Tibet through appropriation of the Mahayana schema. Although already apparent in early authors such as Guru Chowan, this classification acquired its present-day terminology more recently. Nowadays, we know them as firstly Dagnang, or pure vision, meeting the Buddha face-to-face in a vision or dream and receiving teachings. Secondly, Sakar or Satarma, earth treasure, meaning sacred texts concealed within the material world or in the environment. And thirdly, Gongter or mind treasure, a direct divine inspiration of the mind, permitting the spontaneous, confident utterance of Dharma. To summarize, Tibetology has always claimed that Tibet's Tema traditions grew from a mixing of indigenous and Indian influences. Undoubtedly, both India and Tibet had their own treasure cultures that merged over time. So far, however, the Indian influence have remained little explored. I hope to begin this exploration, and it promises to be interesting. On the one hand, we believe there might have been some direct historical continuity between Indian and Tibetan revelatory practices in the largely anonymous revelation of some early Nyingma tantras. As careful calques of Sanskritic tantras and largely based on reused Indian text, they were quite likely produced with the same revelatory methods still used at that time by Indian gurus. By contrast, the slightly later Terma system was a uniquely Tibetan melange of numerous sources with no precise counterparts anywhere else. Unlike Indian Buddhism's largely anonymous Dharmabhanakas and Tantric Siddhas, it openly identified its text revealers. Mixing the contemporaneous Tantric traditions of Kashmir and India with powerful indigenous Tibetan elements, in the spirit of 11th century Tibet, it seems to draw these together within frame narratives inspired by Mahayana Sutra literary motifs long discontinued in India, but which thereby found a remarkable new life in 10th century Tibet. So, thanks.
Thank you, Rob. That was fantastic. That was beautifully clear. And I think after all the previous talks, I really enjoyed to hear how you fit it all together into a bigger picture. So thank you very much for that.